My next guest has set out to tell the secret history of the gay men who defined the pop scene of the 1960s. His new book, The Velvet Mafia, is all about the forward-thinking men who managed pop acts like, well, the people I just played, the Beatles, the Who, the Bee Gees, and who shaped the emerging pop music scene, evolving it from what people assumed would be a passing fad into a global industry, which endures to that this very day. The author of The Velvet Mafia is Daryl W. Bullock. He joins me this evening. I remember, Daryl, you were in with us. In fact, it was January 2020 at the time of the David Bowie Festival in Dublin, before all these lockdowns, etc., started. And you were talking to me then about your book, David Bowie Made Me Gay, which looked at performers who were gay and homosexual performers, and the role that they played in the music industry. I asked you that night, were you going to look behind the scenes at those who were perhaps on that side of the microphone, if you like, and you told me you were writing the book. This is the book you were talking about.
Yes, it is. It's the very book we were talking about, 15 months ago, whenever it was. I'd already finished the book at that point, and it was due out last year, and then COVID happened, so it got put back until February of this year.
So we have 5 pictures on the front of the book, hugely important pictures. Obviously, Epstein, who was involved with the Beatles, is there, Brian. Larry Parnes, Joe Meek, Robert Stigwood and Lionel Bart. Larry Parnes, I don't know if you could call him the father of them all, but it kind of strikes me that the way you tell the story in the book, that he certainly seemed to show the others what might be done. Tell us about him.
I really think he is. I think he's where it all starts. I mean, if you think about Larry's role in British pop music, you know, he's the manager or co-manager of Britain's first rock and roll star, which is Tommy Steele, and that whole stable of stars he had, you know, Billy Fury and Marty Wilde and all those people. It really all starts with Larry. He's incredibly important, not just for fostering that stable of stars, as I've said, but for also acting as a bit of a mentor towards other people. Brian Epstein turned to Larry very, very early on, even before he'd signed the Beatles, 2 years before he'd signed the Beatles, to get advice from him on what he should be doing within the showbiz world. I think Larry modelled his own self, his own business, if you like, on the only superstar manager anybody had ever heard of at that point, who was Elvis's manager, Colonel Tom Parker. But everybody that came after Larry modeled themselves on Larry to an extent. Larry was the first, so he's the one you're going to draw parallels to, I guess.
What was his background and what brought him towards the music industry as opposed to some other walk of life?
Well, Larry, like Brian and like some of the other people in the book, had a retail background. His parents were in the rag trade. They were in the fashion trade. They had clothes shops, and at a very early age, he had his own clothes shops. But he'd always had a passion to perform. He wanted to be, he wanted to be a singer. He wanted to be an actor, but he wasn't really cut out for either of those roles. So very early on, he gravitated towards management. He started investing in theatre in London, and very soon on through that was dragged towards the London coffee shops, the Soho coffee shops in the 50s, where he was, you know, discovering people like Tommy Steele and Marty Wilde.
How significant is it that he came from a Jewish background? Because of those stories that you tell, the major stories that you tell in the book, the Jewishness is a common theme across a few of them.
I think it's very important. I think it was ingrained in people like Larry and Brian and other people we talk about in the books, people like the lawyer David Jacobs. It was kind of ingrained into them by their family that they had to be successful. They're not only dealing with the stigma of being homosexual, but they're also dealing with rampant anti-Semitism, which was occurring in Britain throughout the 30s, 40s and 50s when these guys were growing up and starting to, you know, carve a life of their own. So they're stigmatized already, and it's kind of driven in them by their families. And they all come from very close families, very close-knit families, very supportive families. But it's driven into them that they have to succeed. They have to to rise above this kind of prejudice, this ingrained prejudice, and be better than that.
The other thing that you, and I think you link this into the Jewishness of some of the managers as well, is this: the name changes that often took place. You mentioned Tommy Steele. You know, who of us knew about the singing sailor called Tom Hicks? Not a lot of us, but that is who Tommy Steele, that is who became Tommy Steele.
Well, that's right. And you look at Billy Fury was Ronald Wycherley, and you know, Reg Patterson. Actually, I can't even remember Reg Patterson's other name, but he had a name before that, but it became Marty Wilde. Larry was convinced that you couldn't be a star if you were called Joe Bloggs, and you had to have a name. And he liked to give his artists these names that had a kind of element of danger with Wilde and Fury and whatever, but also had something that was quite comfortable and approachable, like Marty or like Billy. So it was kind of a double-edged thing. On one hand, they were approachable and cuddly, and the younger girls would go for him or go for them. And on the other hand, they had this kind of harder edge that maybe the Teddy Boys and the Tough Nuts would be more attracted to.
And in fact, it's one of the arguments you make in the book that the essential market here was the young teenage girl market, and that these men would know what the young teenage girl would find attractive in a young man, in a young teenage or early 20s man.
Well, I think that's undeniable. If you are a gay man, you do look at people with a very different eye. And yes, I mean, if you fancy, if you as a gay man fancy a young man, there's chances are that girls will fancy him as well, you know? I mean, that's a horrible stereotype, but you get the drift of what I'm talking about. So yes, there's a certain thing going on there that Larry and Brian and people like that are thinking, well, I can see that there's a market for these girls. I can see that I can mold the model, that I can make them more marketable, and I know that I can interest other people in them. Part of that comes from having the queer eye for the straight guy, if you like, but also it comes from the fact that they have this retail background. They all come from retail backgrounds, so they all know how to sell things. They've all got an idea about how to market, how to polish something and make it more presentable.
Yeah, and the retail aspect is there in Epstein, as you said, but there are other aspects that you really bring out in his case and in some of the other cases as well. We've got to remember that you were talking about the late 50s and the early 60s. This is the period you're talking about here. Homosexuality was still illegal. It was still a criminal act in Great Britain at that time, homosexual activity. Now, Epstein has come back from studying at RADA. He's full of shame. He's been arrested twice for persistent importuning in public toilets whilst living in London. These men were living difficult lives at that time. Being openly gay was impossible.
Oh, absolutely. That was absolutely the case. And perhaps that's one of the reasons that they were all attracted towards the theatre, because the theatre has always been that place where you can kind of hide in plain sight, which has always been much more accepting of LGBT people. It's been much easier, I think, for you historically as a gay man or a lesbian woman or a bisexual trans person to find acceptance within that crowd, within that kind of arty milieu, if you like. But yeah, Brian was arrested several times. Brian was blackmailed when he was in Liverpool still. He was beaten up and then blackmailed and had to go to court to face the ignominy of that. Joe Meek, who I write about within the book, you know, the producer of Telstar and Have I Got the Right and all those kind of things, was blackmailed and was arrested for importuning. Joe Orton was constantly importuning. It was a time when you couldn't even walk down the street with another gay man for fear of being arrested. You could be arrested. You could be put in jail before 1967 just for being homosexual. People forget that. People think that the decriminalisation or partial decriminalisation did was allow people of a certain age to have sex. But actually, no. Prior to that, you couldn't even be gay, let alone have sex with somebody. If you were gay, if you were perceived to be gay, you could be arrested on the streets and taken away to the police cells. It was a difficult time, a really difficult time for people. And so I think for Larry and for Brian and for the other people who write about, like Robert Stigwood and so on, part of what they did within the business and within creating their own business model, if you like, was to give them the opportunity to socialize with other people of their type in a safe place.
You mentioned the fact that Epstein, or Ice, mentioned that he came back from RADA to Liverpool, and he was working then in his parents' record shop at the time.
That's right.
So there we get that retail background again. I suppose it doesn't seem as big a step from working in a record shop to working in the music industry in the way that he did with the Beatles. What do you think that retail background, what does it, is it basic, is it marketability, a nose and a recognition of marketability? Is that what it gives these men?
I think it does to an extent, yeah. I mean, Brian spent many years working in retail, working for his parents' shops and working in other shops as well to learn the trade before going back to his parents. And it does give you an idea of what can and can't be sold. I think if you're clued up, and we're talking about a bunch of people, Larry and Brian and Robert Stigwood and Simon Napier-Bell and all those other people we discuss in the book, are very intelligent people. They might not have had great schooling. They might not have done well in school or at university. Actually, most of them didn't go to university. But they really had their finger on the pulse. They understood trends, if you like. And in all fairness, you know, music has trends. It has fashions. And they understood those fashions. They understood how fashion moved things around. And they could see very clearly how what was happening on their doorstep could be marketed if they got the right breaks, if they, you know, they had the right people behind them, they had the right influence or whatever else it might be. It was very much, I think Brian and Larry and the other people, Lionel Bart, people that I would talk about in the book, would not have been as successful, I don't think, even if they haven't had that grounding here, which gave them the opportunity to appreciate a trend.
The other thing about Epstein, I suppose, that's important to talk about is the fact that he did, you know, had been to RADA and did have this desire to be in the performing arts. He wanted a little bit of celebrity for himself as well.
Very much so. I think they all did. And I think Larry, who wouldn't have gone into management if he hadn't have already tried to get into male modelling and already thought about theatre, I think they were all looking for their inroad into show business in some way or another. We go back to you asking me about you know, was the fact that they're Jewish involved in this in any way? And it really is, because if you think about what was happening at that time and what happened immediately prior to this period of the 1950s onwards, most of the successful Jewish men you know about in Britain of that time were the entertainers. They were the people like the Grades and the Delphonts and all those people who had gone from, you know, hoofing it on vaudeville stages to managing theatres and to running multi-million pound industries. So it was a very obvious role for them to, or a route for them rather, to follow this showbiz thing, because they'd seen it happen before. They'd seen their peers do that. So it was a very, very clear route, if you like, out of, you know, running or managing a department in your parents' shop to creating a sustainable, you know, business presence for yourself.
There's another interesting aspect that you bring out in the book, is that the fact that these men, because of the legal situation that you described earlier, they had to suppress or certainly hide their homosexual activity, their homosexuality. So there was suppression involved there. They were quite harsh on their stars in terms of, if you like, suppressing their activities or certainly keeping a squeaky clean image being sent out.
Yes, of course they were. But again, this was a new thing. This really, the whole rock and roll and pop industry hadn't happened before. So every time Larry or Brian or somebody like that had a new artist, a potential star, they had to think about how they could give their career longevity. which is why, you know, within a year, Tommy Steele stops recording rock and roll songs and starts singing things like Little White Bull and all those, you know, all that stuff. Larry is trying to give this guy a career that will last past what they believe is going to be a very transient boom. Rock and roll and pop music won't last more than a couple of years. That's what everybody's telling you. All the record, all the people that own record companies are telling you this will not last. So what they want to do is create a longer career for these people by giving them acting lessons and elocution lessons and so on and so on. But it also means making sure that they don't cause a stink in the press. You know, they don't want them losing their career and therefore obviously losing, you know, the amount of money they're going to pay to their management by making silly mistakes. So that's why you bring in somebody like David Jacobs, the showbiz lawyer who is part of this story, to clear up that mess in case anything happens. You know, in case every time, you know, somebody gets involved in a speeding incident or a drugs incident or something like that, David Jacobs is there to make sure that it's played down.
The book is called The Velvet Mafia, Daryl, with the subtitle The Gay Men Who Ran the Swinging 60s. Very few mentions of women throughout the book. First of all, why do you think that is? And secondly, then, tell me about one of the most important women that is spoken about within the book, Vicky Wickham.
Sure. I mean, the obvious reason, and sadly this is true, is that during the 1950s and 1960s, the industry was run by men. Women, sadly, didn't get involved or weren't given the opportunity to get involved in the running of the business until someone like Vicky Wickham comes along. Vicky was originally a showrunner on Ready, Steady, Go, you know, massively influential TV pop show, and went from there to becoming the series producer or co-producer, and went from there to becoming Dusty Springfield's manager and working in management, songwriting, publishing, all those kind of things she moves into. But in 1965, 66, when Vicky is starting to become a very important player in the industry, there really was nobody else. Women in the industry at that time, women singers, women artists even, were kind of marketed or manufactured or publicized in a certain way. They were very pigeonholed, and very few had the chance to step outside of that. And when you did step outside of that, you normally got your wrist slapped, you know. Mm. It's not really until the 1970s, and we see the involvement of the women's liberation movements and things like that, and women start to become much more involved in the industry and really start to take a major role in things like management and stuff like that. You have female artists, obviously, but not a single artist was out until Dusty started talking about his sexuality in 1970, which is the period, you know, after the book set.
And I guess maybe the material for another book after
this.
Well,
maybe. You never know. Call me again next year.
Yeah. Good to speak with you this evening, Daryl.
Thanks very much, Sean. Love to you all.
That's Daryl W. Bullock there, speaking about his book, The Velvet Mafia, The Gay Men Who Ran the Swinging 60s. It's published by Omnibus Press.